Welcome to Silence Voices, Stories of MST, the podcast dedicated to survivors of military sexual trauma. Join host Rachel Smith and guests as we provide resources, community, and support for those navigating the aftermath of MST. Together, we aim to raise awareness and foster understanding. If you're struggling, you're not alone. Hey there, welcome to another episode of Silence Voices, Stories of MST. As always, I'm your host, Rachel Smith. Today, I think I would have a difficult time explaining our guest, Jeanette Garcia, because she is just one of a kind. She had such an experience growing up and then joining the military and then deploying and then trying to live life after that. You'll hear her story all throughout this episode, but you'll also hear how she's conquered it and what she's doing to move forward. I have another hero, but I mean, I think you hear that every single episode. And that is this incredible woman. She's so strong. She's so dedicated. And the love that she has for her family is truly inspiring. And I'm just honored to be able to have her here. So without further ado, here's Jeanette.
Hey, Jeanette, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing so good. Thank you so much for having me today. This is going to be a great conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And I spy your book back there. I got mine here too. So thank you so much for writing this and sharing your story. So we'll just start from the top. What influenced you to join the military, and then which branch did you choose?
Yeah, so me joining the military was kind of what am I going to do next in my life step. I was 21 years old and I was like, I don't want to be stuck in this town. So I need to go do something. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go serve our country. I'm going to go, you know, get out of here and do something like worth living for. And I decided to join, and I joined the United States Army.
Woo! Awesome. Awesome. And I had noticed in your book, you kind of looked at a couple different services. What about the Army had stood out to you?
Well, to be honest, they were not my first choice, and they were kind of my only choice because of my tattoos, which is so weird because nowadays they can have tattoos all over the place. And I had, now I'm like all tatted up, but I had the small tattoo right here that's covered up now. And it said the word faith. And then in my neck, it's like I have like an arrow with the arrows pointing out. And the Air Force wouldn't take me because of these tattoos. The Marines.
Oh my goodness.
And the Army is like, yeah, we'll just write a waiver for it. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, because like now I think you could look like, I don't know, Jack Sparrow or something. And
seriously.
A part of the military. That's so silly, but I am glad that you were able to join and serve. So what was that like when you did get to basic and just take on military life? Did you have any family members that had previously joined?
Yeah, so two of my cousins were Marines. They both went to Iraq. One of my cousins actually was there when they invaded Iraq. They're super awesome, powerful men, and the military really did affect them. Like the Marines affected he's the oldest cousin of all of us. He definitely has, you know, like from being in Iraq and seeing whatever he saw, but they inspired me to do it. You know, when I asked them questions about it, they're like, you know, do it. And they're like, go Marines, go to the Marines. And I couldn't.
Yeah.
I was actually really afraid to join the Marines too, to be honest.
If I would have been, heck yeah. Were they encouraging, or did they have like any warnings for you, like to mind your P's and Q's or watch out for this before you went in?
No, actually everyone I knew, I had friends already in the military at this point. Nobody discouraged me. I also didn't tell my family that I was joining until I was like ready to leave, because I didn't want anyone to be like, don't go. So by the time I got to my parents, I was already gonna leave.
Gotcha. Yeah. I had read about you had a going away party, and that was kind of an event. Do you want to share a little bit of what that was like?
That, you know, I will say this. I was definitely 21. I acted like a 21-year-old.
Yep.
And that was actually one of the reasons I wanted to leave, was because alcohol and partying and like that whole lifestyle was something I wanted to get away from. So like that night that I explain in there describes like the last 3 years of my life at that point, where it was alcohol, it was like a fight, it was like an argument, it was an outrageous reaction from me. And it that like that event itself had to do a lot with the cousin I speak about in that event is my Marine cousin, and then my oldest sister, my only sister, my sister. And at that time, me and my sister had a really like, we butt heads all the time. And I always felt like I can never be who she was. She had just graduated ASU. She's very successful, beautiful, like intelligent. And then there's me, the black sheep of the family. So anything she would say, I would be offended, you know, like I was like, I'm so offended by you even looking at me. So that's basically what happened that day.
I understand. Oh, those sibling rivalries, I swear.
And so when you went into,
yeah, that's how it goes. My younger brother and I kind of had something like that when we were little. But it sounds like when you went to basic, it kind of gave you an opportunity to mature some and just kind of grow as an adult and really find a path in the world.
It definitely did. Every time people ask me, like, would you tell this woman or this man to join the military? I'm like, absolutely. If it wasn't for the discipline I got in the military, the type of education I got in there for like my career, and the people there who encouraged me, who pushed me, I wouldn't be the woman I am today. Like, if it wasn't for them, I would, like, the military and everyone around me, I would definitely be, you know, I could be in a bar somewhere right now. So it's definitely life-changing for sure.
Absolutely. I understand. And so, yeah, what was the experience like with BASIC? Were you already kind of exercising before you went, or it was just like, oh, shit, here I am?
Oh, my gosh, no. I mentioned it in my book. Like, when I get to BASIC, I have my hair down, you know, my long hair. I'm so cute. And they run us off the bus, and, like, they're like, where do you think you're going, to the club or something? I don't even have a ponytail. But no, I didn't work out before. Like, I would do like things, but not the way I did like when I was in the military, like learning how to run, do push-ups and stuff like that. Like, I did not prepare. I literally, when I signed up, I left like 2 to 3 weeks later. Like, I was like gone. Oh, it was like the fastest process.
Wow.
Yeah, so I no one told me to study for like the ASVAB. No one told me that I was going to be doing like,
yeah,
like rucking. My body and everything was not prepared.
Oh, man. But I'm sure by the time it was over, you were like, just like, okay, bring it. You get conditioned after a few weeks. Because, I mean, you have no choice. So
basically.
Yeah. And then after, when you were finished with training, and it's AIT that you go to afterward, correct? Or
AIT. Mine was different than most people. It's called OSET. So it's BASIC and AIT combined. Like, we got no break in between or anything. So I was there for the whole 6 months with the same drill sergeant, with the same people in my platoon. Like, we sucked it out.
Yeah. Oh, man. And when you were in that, since it does sound like you were just somewhat rebellious before you joined, was it hard to kind of acclimate to all of that discipline?
It wasn't hard for me, because I know how to, I'm really good with adults. Like, I always have been since I was younger. My friends are always older. I was always friends with like my bosses or the older people at like a job and stuff like that. So it was actually easy to get along with like my drill sergeants, because there's something about me, like, I don't treat you like a leader. Not that you're not, I treat you like a human. and I don't make it like awkward for me to have a conversation with you. Like, I'm not like a scared little puppy. So I think they kind of liked it like that. And a lot of the people in my basic, which was, I think, a little bit more rare, a lot of us were 21 and older. So we were kind of like an older group mixed in with like younger people. So they spoke to us very like adult-like, I guess you could say. And I don't know if it wasn't like that in other basic trainings, but in mine, it was really easy for me. And I love the discipline. I like the schedule. I like knowing like what I'm going to do, when I'm going to do it, where I'm going to do it, who's going to be there. So even now, like, I like that structure. And if I don't have that structure, my life kind of goes like a little chaotic.
Same here. And you really get used to even just healing or hearing like reveille and taps and all of that. Like, oh, okay, this is where I need to be right now. So what was it like to get to your first duty station and just exist? Now you're a member of the Army.
Oh, man. It was, you know, like our first duty station, I was so afraid because now I know I didn't have like the structure that you have like in basic training. Mm-hmm. And everyone just told me like, be careful, don't get married, be careful who you're with and all like where you go. I went to Alaska and it's really rare that this happens. I feel like my whole story is rare. Like I'm going to say that all the time, but 19 from my basic training, we all went to Alaska and we all got put in a platoon, like in the same platoon in Alaska. And then there was like a bunch like people from other basic trainings that showed up. We were like they were starting this new thing with I was with the 125 infantry and they were trying it out and they were putting a platoon of MPs within the unit. So most of my, like the first 3 years of my career was working with the infantry. We did some patrol, but not most of it was basically training. And it was awesome. I loved it. I loved Alaska. Yeah. I loved like the first couple of months was like learning and doing something new. And they were in Iraq. So we kind of had it easy because we didn't have a platoon sergeant yet. We didn't even have squad leaders. We were literally taking care of one another until we got our leadership like a couple months later.
Awesome. And what was the transition from Arizona to Alaska? Holy crap.
Horrible. Yeah. It was so bad. Oh my gosh. So I got there in August and I was already like, oh my gosh, it's so cold here. And so we got our platoon sergeant, I want to say came in like October or November. I want to say October. And so we were there from August to like October by ourselves. And he would literally have our formation outside. And like at the end of the day, like 5 o'clock, we're thinking he's going to let us go. He would make us stand out there with no jacket, like just our uniform, no extra like layering. And we're just like there. He's just telling us like these stories to get us acclimated. And we're just like, oh my gosh, it's so cold. He just stopped talking. But honestly, I think it worked. Not at the time. We were like to us, please.
I'm sure. That sounds miserable. I actually had to do that transition myself. My mom had gotten stationed up in Alaska and we went from Mississippi to Alaska.
Oh my gosh.
And we left in October and we drove all the way from Mississippi up through Canada, like through the Yukon and all of that. So we kind of had a little bit of acclimation each state, but still it was like they might as well have put us on like Pluto or something, you know, like it was so cold.
What part of Alaska were
so
you guys
I
in?
Get it in Anchorage, so we were
Anchorage is warmer than Fairbanks,
like, yeah, like you were in Fairbanks degrees.
yeah
And so if I'm one former Alaskan to another, what was it like for you when you saw winter solstice? Because no one believes me unless they've been there.
It was, you know what? It was so amazing. Like, I loved it. I did have, like, I would go tanning, like, religiously every week because I was, like, kind of, like, sad. And they're like, oh, if you do this, and it worked. Like, it really made a difference. But the first time I saw the aurora lights, oh, my gosh. I was in heaven. Yeah. I was doing 24-hour CQ. And it was like 2 a.m. and my sergeant was like, you know what? Go outside and get fresh air. And I was like, what? It's cold. Like, I ain't going out there. He goes, go out there. It's an order. And when I went out there, the lights were dancing. And I was like, thank you for making me go outside because it was beautiful. Yeah. It's something to experience for sure. But not the whole
night all day. Yeah, I was telling people, like, around, there's the summer solstice, so you lose light, like, incrementally each day after that, but then it seems like all of a sudden in November, it's just dark. And then it gets darker. But it's just hard to get used to, and like explaining things like seasonal affective disorder to others, they really don't get it until they're in like a more northern state. Then it's like, oh, okay, this is real. But
it's definitely
when
real.
You go to a place like that, yeah. When you go to a place like, I don't know, Washington State or Alaska, you really do have to kind of keep your mental health in check, and you really wouldn't have known that prior to going there, but you find out. And it's an experience, though. Like, I tell people, even if you're not like a person that enjoys winter, it's just a place to experience. If you get the chance, just do it.
Yeah, I agree, and the food's great.
Yeah. I'm guessing you had like bear and moose and all of that too.
All of it. I did. I tried it all. Yep. I was like, give it to me.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, we had caribou. So that's also reindeer. And people are like, you want a reindeer? Like, yeah. Sure did.
Yep. The Silver Gold over there. It's like a fancy restaurant. They had caribou. Right. Cheddar soup, and it was heaven. It was so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's just so much culture up there, and it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And then when you see summer, like if you see a photo of summer next to winter, you would never believe it's the same place. But it's just magical.
Yeah,
absolutely magical. So when you, as your military career continued, you ended up deploying with that unit, correct?
Yes, we deployed to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it and was definitely
can you share
a time
what that experience is like?
Yeah. So I was part of what is known as a female engagement team. So when it started, they were the Lioness in the Marines, and then the Army took it on as well. And now they're known as female engagement teams throughout the branches. And it's a group of 2 to 3 women that would go with the infantry units to give them cultural support, since the men can't speak with women. That's what we were there for. Right. So it was a lot of, I did a lot of searching. I was an MP, I was military police. So I was really good at it. And they had me train, like our other FETs, they would have me train the infantry guys. They would have me train the Afghan police on how to search and how to look for certain things, or how to touch a woman if there's no one else, because you touch them with the back of your hand, you don't grope, you don't, you know, you have to be careful in like your language that you use with the woman. So it was the best and worst experience of my life. We definitely saw a lot of combat when I was there. I was in a really bad spot. So we were the first American unit to be in the Horn of Panjue. We took over the Canadians, and within that first year, we lost 22 men. And we've had medevacs almost every other day, I feel like. Somebody got injured or hurt. I myself was also in multiple explosions, but one directly with my interpreter stepped on an IED, and we all got blasted. And she lost both her legs. I have a TBI from it and like head injury. But it was, you know, I do explain it in my book, like in detail, like that experience, but it was definitely something that you never forget, not even like the scent of things. But even though this horrible thing happened to us, I still think it's best and worst experience because it humbled me. I'm definitely not the woman I was before I left. And every day I grow from those experiences. I just met with my girlfriends this past weekend. After 12 years, we got together and it was just like, it was like heaven in a way that no one else knows what we've been through. And my friend who lost both her legs, you know, seeing her in great spirits gives us hope, you know, that, you know, everything we've been through is because God created it prior to us being on this world. And that's what it was supposed to be.
I can't imagine. And just seeing them again after all of that, did you guys spend like a week together or afternoon? Yeah. Like, what was that like?
It was a week. I think we got there Wednesday and we spent every day together. But the first night was like the first night we ever spoke about it in like a group, and the people who were there for this event were myself and my interpreter, and then the other girls just happened not to be there for this patrol. So when we get to the speaking of it, I never realized that they had guilt from not being there. I had guilt because I always said it should have been me and not my interpreter because she was my responsibility. And, you know, and then Millie sees it like in a whole different way. Like our interpreter, she has like a whole different mindset of it. And I was like, oh man, like if you piece these all together, it's like a complete puzzle. But all of us are trying to piece like somebody else's emotion to take care of one another instead of like knowing that we all felt like a guilt in a way. And It I think it healed us a little bit, but it definitely brought us closer in our relationship. Like we're like, we can't spend this much time away from each other because nobody knows this part about us. And there is nobody more comfortable that I'm with to speak about it. Mm-hmm. Like when I talk about it, someone's like, yeah, like I remember that. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like, sometimes I feel like I made it up in my head. Like this is all just like, a big story in my life. And no, it's like my reality. Like this actually happened. And, you know, I am who I am, especially who I was like even a couple of years ago because of this event. And I it's just like now it's like a huge healing process, even 12 years later.
I understand. And I'm so happy that you got to meet up with them again and just see how they've all managed to grow and change after something like that, because it is life-changing completely, especially if you lose a limb, but also mentally. And when you had that experience, how did your family react to that?
I didn't tell them. I told them like 5 years later, like everything that happened. Well, actually, no, I'll take it back. It had to be the year I got back. I told them only because I went to go visit my interpreter that next year. Like I made it a point for me to go see her because her and I were the ones that had went through this. And I just needed to know she was okay. And when I went to go see her the first time, she seemed okay, but you know what? In my heart, I knew that she wasn't healed yet from what we went through. But what was great is that she never blamed me for it. Instead, she was just thankful that I was there with her.
Yeah.
Because I thought she was going to blame me. I thought she was going to be like, it's all your fault. And I was like, no. You know, my dreams were like, it's your fault. So it was great to hear that. Yeah. It wasn't my fault.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then also throughout your time in the military, you had experiences with MST and domestic violence. Can you share some on that?
So this was all, so now we're going to go back to the beginning of the year. So I left for deployment in April, May. I think it was like the first week of May. I experienced domestic violence in February, and then I got raped in March. I got raped in April. I got raped right before I deployed. So it was literally back to back to back to back to back to back traumas that I never healed from. So my husband, who now I am friends with and I have forgiven, so I have no ill wish on him. But at the time we were young, there was alcohol involved. There was jealousy involved, and it's not an excuse for his actions. But, you know, he did what he did to me. And I hid it from everyone because I was like so ashamed, like that the person that loved me the most would do something so horrific to me. So then we went to I guess this happened like in January, because then we went to NTC for the whole month of February. And then when we came back, like maybe a week or two later, I was like, you know what? Can I have a divorce? And to my shock, he already had the papers ready. Like I don't know if he knew or he wanted one too, or he was expecting it. Like he was like, yeah, here you go. And I signed, and like literally a month later, I was divorced. It was fast. Which is great because I
experienced all of these traumas together, and you have a divorce is a trauma, you know, it's a separation. What was going through your mind after all of this? Just boom, 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 boom.
Oh man, I felt ashamed more than anything. I felt like I'm not good enough for anybody. That I was just used. Like, why is this happening to me? I've always been a Christian, and I was like, why is God letting all of this bad stuff happen to me? Like, is this payback for being so wild in my like younger years? I questioned God a lot. I questioned myself. I questioned, like, you know, is it because I'm not pretty enough? Is it because I have such, like, is it my personality? Like, I took all the blame for all of it, and I just didn't know where to place it. And there, you know, honestly, there was no way to place it. That's just what life, the cards life gave me. But it was really hard. It took years for me to be confident again. I lost a lot of my confidence. I lost a lot of feeling like beautiful, and the wanted kind of stuff like was gone. Like that was like out the door. If you were a man at that point and you told me that I was pretty, you were like awesome to me, because I didn't feel that way. And then I would always like question, like, what do you really want? Like, what's happening right now? Because I wouldn't let that get close to me again.
I understand. And that's so much pain to carry around. Did you lean on prayer at all, or going to church to try and find some sort of guidance?
Not at the time. So I didn't have a chance to do anything for the whole year since I was in Afghanistan. And where I would find, like, I guess my release was when I came back, it was in a bottle of wine. That was like my escape from my reality. And once, you know, and then I was promiscuous on top of it. So it was like the combination of the worst things, you know, not seeking God. It was like seeking the world, and it was just bad. When I left Alaska, I got a little bit better because I got out of my environment. And I don't want to say I was alone, but I was by myself in a new duty station with people who didn't know me. They didn't know anything that had happened to me. I met a guy that became my friend and is now the father of my son. And, you know, one thing leads to another, you have a baby. But but at the time, my son is
who, just how it goes.
Yeah. My dog and my son, because I got a dog who I believe saved my life when I was really, really depressed. And after having my dog for a few months, I got pregnant, and my son and they're like the biggest blessings of my life.
Yeah. And your dog, was it just the fact that you had to get out of bed to take care of your pup that kind of helped you move forward? Or it was just it was like having dog affection and everything?
All of it. It was like he was a puppy and the cutest little thing you could see. And I dressed him up. I got him ready. He was with me. Everywhere I went, he would go with me. Aww. And no one would tell me, like, he's not allowed in here. So I actually say that because of my dog, I got pregnant. So he wasn't allowed in the barracks. So my friend had his own place. And I was like, hey, can I leave my dog at your place? And I had to be there all the time because of my dog. But Loki's, he's still with me today. He's 11 years old. I couldn't be without him. He's going to live forever. I just want people to know he's going to be those dogs. He's like a human being. He really, really did save my life. So, and then having my son, you know, taking care of a human and a dog's two different things. But my son gave me purpose for life again.
Yeah, I understand. Were you trying to just combat depression on top of everything else when you got to your new duty station? Did you reach out to seek any mental health resources at all?
Not at all.
Oh, man.
No.
Yeah.
Like when you're going through the processing coming back from deployment and you go see mental health and everything, because of what I've went through, I was on Celexa. I was on Ambien and like some other stuff. And I told them, I don't want this stuff. Like, they gave this to me when I was deployed. And I was like, I don't want this. It was like so bad. So when I got back, they tried another antidepressant. And I just was like a zombie. And I didn't want it. Like, don't give me medication. I don't think it was actually helping me. If not, it was just making it worse, because then I would fester in whatever I was feeling instead of being able to get out of it, like going to the gym or going to speak to somebody. Because I would work out before that incident. I actually would work out like twice a day. And when I came back to Alaska, I wasn't going to the gym anymore. And I never realized it for a while. And I was like, you know what? Like, I'm not doing the things that I do. I'm just working, drinking, going out with my friends, like nothing else. And, you know, it was kind of the lifestyle, because everybody was doing the same thing. It wasn't like anybody was doing anything different. So I was in a normalcy, basically, with that lifestyle at the moment. But it wasn't until my son was about 3 years old that I looked in myself and I said, I need God again in my life. And I began, my cousin invited me to church and I began going to church. And when my son was 4, I recommitted my life to the Lord and I got baptized again. And ever since then, you know, slowly, it's been a really slow process, but I know that not everyone's process is the same with, you know, building that relationship with him. But from then till now, our growth in my relationship with the Lord is like to the roof, and it's never perfect. You know, my flesh and my sins always want to come back, and my the bad memories come and sneak in and tell me the things that I don't want to hear, and I have to turn to Him, or there's nothing else there for me, because I have to do it because of my son. And my son goes, Mom, we have to pray right now, okay? Let's just pray.
Aww.
And we'll like start praying. That's and I'll sweet. Be like, you're right, Ryan. Like, you're right. That's exactly what I did.
I love that. Is there a particular Bible verse that you go to when you need like a moment of peace or to like reaffirm yourself?
No, not like a specific verse, but basically for the Lord telling us to not fear, or the like to fear or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really bad when you put me on the spot and I need to remember one of them. But
understand.
You know, it's like have no fear that He's with me. You know, that I do everything through Him. And then one thing that I'm this year that I'm taking on is, you know, fulfilling his word by loving my neighbor. So in all of my reactions right now, I'm like seeing because I was angry. So my reactions were not kind to people. So now I'm seeing like, okay, how could I do this and still show love? Because, you know, even in a disagreement, you could do it out of a loving place. So when I'm not doing it in a loving place, I'll call that person back and I'll explain my reaction. So my son now, like, let's say I'm in the car and I yell and he just happens to be there, and I'll be like, oh, be quiet. I go back to the situation. I'll be like, hey, Ryan, do you know why this happened? And I'll explain to him everything in the process of that happening. I'll be like, that was mom's reaction. That was not towards you. You did nothing wrong. And I'll have him repeat it to me. That way I know he understood what I said, because I feel like in his beginning years, that whenever I was having trauma, that it was just reaction and why is she freaking out? Like, or what is happening right now? So I'm taking that on. Like, that really is working, I think, at least for me.
I think that's wonderful. That's such a wonderful way to go about it, though, because I think a lot of times when you feel fear, it does come out as anger. So for you to actually go through and process each emotion and give a cause and effect, and like then also explain it to your son, like he has very good emotional processing now, I'm guessing, because he's able to work through everything from like A to Z. That is so special that has come out of you healing and moving forward.
Yeah, I wish someone taught me that when I was younger.
Right. Yeah. And that is one thing with trauma as well, is if you don't really have good identifiers for what might trigger you, whether it's, you know, getting scared all of a sudden in traffic because someone cut you off, like me, that used to cause like a full on panic attack of someone just like beeping their horn and being a jerk. So, but there were other triggers that, like certain smells, like you had mentioned before, I had no idea that they were going to trigger me, but being able to identify them and then have like a plan and being able to work through it that way logically is so beneficial. So to any of our listeners, if you're struggling with triggers, do what Jeanette's doing, because that I'm sure there's not a therapist out there or any sort of thought leader or religious person that would be like, no, that's not a good idea. So yeah, you can have like a great system. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Thank you.
So when you, yeah, absolutely. No, I love hearing when people prosper and they, not only do they do the work on themselves, but they share that work and with even their children, but other people in their lives, and help them make more informed decisions and really understand their reactions. Because not only does it make it easier for you to exist as someone with PTSD and having triggers, but they also know, okay, I cannot fly off the handle right now because it's going to affect her. I'm going to be upset. And then there's this whole ripple effect. So you've essentially made everybody around you like raise their emotional intelligence. And that's awesome. That is so awesome. I love the nerdy side of mental health and growth. So that's just me.
That's the best part of it.
But,
they're tools.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So with your book, let's chat about that. So this is her book, Battle Scars. I got my copy directly from your website, but where else is it available?
Right now it's available on Amazon, and then soon it will be available on Barnes & Noble's and then Google Pages. So we're just waiting for them to release it, but it'll be nice when it's at Barnes & Noble. People like to go physically grab it.
That's true. There's something about being able to. What was the experience like putting all of this on paper, all of your experiences and like the internal thoughts?
Stressful. No, it was, that was my therapy, basically. So I started doing it in 2017. I was like, you know what? I'm going to share my story, because that's when I started telling people that these things happened to me. And I started with social media, and I was getting great feedback. So then people were like, oh, would you consider speaking about this at an organization? And I was like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like, do I get to prepare anything? I was like, how do you prepare your story when you already wrote it? Like, it's already happened to me. Like, there's nothing that you could ask me that's wrong.
Yeah.
So yeah. Slowly, the more you write, the more you put it down, you're like, oh my gosh, this also happened. Oh, I remember this. Or, mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh, like the whole thing came together. And I was like, my sister and I were like, you should put it in a book. And I was like, I should put it in a book. Like, this is great. So when we were thinking about doing that, I was doing speaking engagements and I thought about doing the book like in 2020. And I wanted to join like speaking guilds or whatever. And nobody or a lot of them, I'll say a lot of them won't accept you unless you were a published author. And I was like, well, that's dumb because I could speak without having something like physical. So I was like, okay, now I really have to do this because now, you know, if I want to go speak at with bigger audiences with these type of people, then I need to have something physical. So then I started working on putting it on paper. How am I going to deliver this with still being kind to people, not making anyone a target? Because I don't want anyone to go up to any of these men and be like, you did this to her. Like, yes. And I've already spoken with them, so I already did my healing. I don't need other people to go up to them. So
right.
I was very careful on how I like brought it out. But even my ex-husband, he read my blog before it became a book and he called me and he's like, can you give me that information? I want to share it with somebody else because it will help them. Mm. And he took full responsibility for his actions and he knew I was doing this and he was okay with it. Because I also think there's a story that's untold is the trauma of the men who do this and why they do this. And not all of them could heal. Not all of them are those that like could have a change like my ex-husband did because his change is remarkable and that's thanks to the Lord. But we know that not everybody's like that. So I always want people to know like, yes, yeah. This is great, my outcome. And I understand that that's not going to be your story, but we could change our own story and how we could go in our future without having to have somebody say sorry to us. Because we don't really need it. We don't need somebody to be like, oh, I'm sorry for what I did. I don't care. Like, I do care. Thank you so much that you said sorry.
Yeah.
And right. I didn't need it because I'm strong enough to continue my life without that reoccurring trauma coming again. So then I wrote the book.
Right. And the sooner. That's so important because it seems like the sooner you sort of make your peace after getting it out of you, that's when that strength comes of, I don't need this person to say sorry to me because I've the forgiveness is already in here. And some people are not of the opinion that you need to forgive. Some people are like, well, you should stay angry and use that as motivation. And other people are like, if I didn't forgive, that I wouldn't be able to be who I am now. And I personally, I'm in I just needed to move on and leave that person alone. But I think like you can have the anger though, but it's like righteous anger. Like if you do something positive with that anger, instead of like, you know, drinking and drugging and numbing yourself. So I see both sides to it, but I truly think that's amazing that you are able to both reach that space of forgiveness, but he also is trying to help people after having done something like that. It's a testament to humanity and just, you know, how much growth we're all capable of if we put our minds to it, to be honest. So that's so wonderful. And your son, have you kind of explained any of all of the things that have happened to you to him?
No. So he's kind of like, he's 10. So now he's curious because he's seen the book. He hears me speaking. He knows. So my ex-husband is not my son's father. Like two completely different people. So he knows that somebody in the past has hurt me physically. He doesn't know about the sexual trauma. And he knows parts of what I went through in Afghanistan. But I think because of his age, I don't want to introduce ideas or thoughts into his head until they're appropriate. Like I tell people, this book is not for children. This is not for like my nieces and nephews to be reading. This is for an adult. Maybe a 17, 16-year-old could understand it already. But other than that, like, I don't want like a young kid reading this stuff because I don't want to introduce those thoughts to them. But he knows. He knows because he knows that sometimes he has to be strong for me. And I tell him, it's not your job to be strong for me. But thank you so much for like petting my hair when I'm crying or, you know, when I can't get out of bed. Like he brings me like food and stuff like that. And it's not his job to do that. And I thank God that he gave me a son that is so, he's like the best. Like this kid is like 25 years old. He's like smarter than me, more like he's very like into his education and finances, and he's awesome. So I'm really grateful for having him, you know, in my life because he's great.
It sounds like he has like a very old soul and lots of empathy. That's so sweet. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I'm so happy. We're blessed with him. My goodness. That's, and I don't know. When little boys are sweet like that, like it just continues into adulthood with them. And it's so wonderful to see.
I hope so.
It's just like, okay, somebody's mom out there did, but it's just like, mom did a great job. Go mom.
Yeah.
So what has it been like now that this book is out with your family members, now that they kind of have this open book to things that you weren't really prepared to speak about? That must have been hard for them to kind of digest all of that.
It was, I honestly don't think my parents have read it because they don't want to know. But my sister was the first one to read it out of everyone in the world. You know, she read it within like an hour. She just like the whole thing. And she calls me and she said, I'm sorry, nobody was there for you. And we just like both of us like bawled. And I was like, it's okay. Like, I didn't tell you. Like, how would you have known? And she's like, I'm just sorry that you felt that way, that you just had to go through all of this by yourself. And, you know, you had nobody, like you weren't comfortable enough to even tell anybody. And I go, you know what? I wasn't, and I am now. So, you know, now that I'm healed, and she goes, you're not healed yet, because I feel like, she was like, I feel like you're like, you know, you're not this person, Janet. You're not this. And I'm like, I feel healed. And I feel like because she wasn't there for the process of my healing and I didn't speak with her, that it was really, really hard for her. I actually also, my brother probably will never read this because I know he's, we're like this. And I think this would just kill him. But my cousins and my friends that have read it, they're just so proud of me being able to put it out there to be able to help other people. I've had tons of female veterans on social media messaging me privately how this is their story. Like, I just told their story, and it makes me happy and sad because it's really sad to know that other people went through this. Like, this is not okay. It's not okay to be living with knowing that your husband beat you, knowing that the person, like a person you're supposed to trust, rapes you, knowing that, you know, that like you can lose your legs when you go to deploy. Like, this is hard stuff. And a lot of women are living through this every day now that, you know, that I'm speaking with them. And I'm also giving them courage to speak to somebody. Oh, yeah. So now I've became a space for them. And that makes me happy. Like, I know that I did it. As long as I changed one person's life, I'm happy with being able to share all of it with everyone.
That's amazing. And that is truly, I think, the best thing that can come out of something like this is that drive to help others, so that you know how alone you felt. And I know how alone I felt when I was going through that. So being able to be that safe space for someone else is, it's very validating, and in like a sad way, because you just want this to stop. But I'm glad that someone feels safe to come to me to share what's happened to them.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that maybe it will be like, you know, when I get better, or you get better, and we help like three other people and they help three more, and it just grows and grows and grows. And maybe that will be the end of it, is just all of these people have finally, let's see, gotten this message out there, or the idea that like this just isn't okay. We all need to love each other, like you said, like do things through love. And I mean, even in the military, yes, your job is, you know, defending the country, but that doesn't mean you should be afraid of your fellow service member or even worried about them. That's supposed to be your brother or sister in arms. So the quicker that becomes the truth, then the quicker stuff like this ends. So I really applaud you just putting this all out there, because it's incredibly hard to not only speak about it, but it's much more vivid when you're writing, because your brain is like cycling through and you can see it, you know, in your mind's eye, and that does make it incredibly difficult. So that's how long did it take? How long did the whole writing process take, and from like, I guess when you started maybe with a pen all the way to publishing?
Oh, 3 years. 3 years.
I believe
3 years. With the publisher, it took me a year, because, you know, they try to make it sound better because it needs to be well written. But some of the words, I was like, you have to change this back. This is like exactly what was said, or this is exactly what happened. And I don't want that one word to change the way that I'm trying to say it, because now that you know me, you see my personality. Like if you hear it, if you're reading it, you have to hear me. If there's like a word that doesn't, like they said the word giggle for something, and I was like, I would never say that. Like I would never use the word giggle. I was like, you guys got to take that whole thing out.
I don't giggle.
Like who giggles?
I understand. Like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but like, I don't giggle. I understand. I totally understand.
But it was definitely I just told my friend today, I was like, I think you should have probably been my ghostwriter, because it's easier when somebody knows you or they understand you to write something about you than someone that's like trying to figure out. So they thought it was like a fake story. I go, this is my life. You guys are writing. They're like, oh, we're so sorry. I was like, okay.
Oh, wow. Woo. What a mistake.
Yeah.
What a mistake to make. Wow. So with you having lived through these experiences, and also found some very good methods of coping, whether it's through prayer or working through the emotion and the reaction, what is it like for you when you see the headlines, like what happened back in 2020 with Vanessa Guillen, or prior to that, even when I was in college, there was the military or the Air Force basic training scandal with the TIs and the brand new airmen. How does it feel when you see things like that? Like it's still continuing.
Oh man, it pisses me off. And I think one, it's like a society problem. And then it's also like a legislative problem. And then it's within the military community. Like there's multiple parts that play into it. Society doesn't listen to my story. You know, my story's not a headline. Like, oh, well, look at, she just spoke about all of these things that happened to her in the military. You know, unless I was dead. If I got murdered tomorrow, if someone kills me in a car accident today,
they're gonna
make a movie about me, because this is like, I can't believe this actually happened to somebody. But unless I'm dead, you know, they don't want to hear it. You know, what happened to Vanessa is horrible. Like her sisters did so well in continuing her name and fighting for her at the Capitol and making something pass that affects all of us, because they didn't do that just for her. They did that for every service member that is going to benefit from what they fought for. And, you know, it shouldn't take someone dying for us to be fighting for those type of things. And that's where it comes to military culture. I fell into it. I didn't speak about it. I kept their names quiet. Under the rug. And it took years for me to speak about it. And then as a community, you know, we should be blasting all of our stories out there. There should be like headlines every day about, oh, here's another one that came out. And one thing that I personally think that ruined us is when women falsely accuse men of raping them. It hurts the entire movement. So when you have people like Jean Carroll that just did that to Trump, and there's no proof that Trump raped her, or the people in the Me Too movement that spoke about just getting sexually harassed because somebody called them cute, that's hurting us that actually went through these things. And now how can we get people to listen to us if people are lying about what they've been through? And why are we like, because it sucks to say that, because I hate to say, I don't believe you. I hate to say, like, is it true though? Like, now we have to question it when someone says it, because so many people in the past have falsely accused, and that that part I don't think we could fix. I think the only thing we could do, but it really, like, you got me riled up, because it really pisses me off when I hear the headlines. I'm like, what can we do? You know, what can we do to make this, you know, more prominent, more that people know that this is still happening? There's a woman in the military that is getting beat by her husband, that is getting raped at the moment by one of her, you know, someone that she's supposed to trust. That's deployed, and they're getting shot at the moment. Like, we don't know what's happening. And if we don't share our stories, we just continue in the silence of, okay, well, it's just a quiet story we know, but we don't talk about.
Yeah. I think a lot of that also is culturally, there's a lot of fear in that of coming forward. Like, I know, even when I was starting the podcast, I haven't really had a panic attack since about 2022-ish or like the end of 2022, beginning of 23. But I had some sincere reservations about starting this, because I was scared that somehow, somewhere, somebody was going to, you know, find me or do something crazy, or I was going to get like doxxed or something like that. And it did take a couple therapy appointments to kind of come up with maybe like, okay, so this is my contingency plan for this, and this is what I'm going to do if this happens. Did you feel that way when you were getting ready to write? Was there any nervousness beforehand?
I think there still is. I think I'm just waiting for that moment where someone just tries to make it out to be that this didn't happen to me, that I'm making it up, that, you know, my life isn't my life. It is something I do think about all the time, because I'm waiting for like the shoe to drop, basically. Like,
right.
Okay, this is going good right now, but like, who's going to question it, or who's going to be mad that I'm like telling their person to go out and get help, or to go seek, go to a shelter and seek counseling or whatever, because their husbands could take it out on me for assisting them also. So for the military, like, can you please stop talking about this? Can you stop like sharing your story? Like, we don't want all of this to be out there. Well, never. I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the point you made about there having to be death for there to be action. I completely agree. It should never get to that space. Like, to me personally, just what I've learned in therapy is that before people escalate to rape, like, say it's not someone that like just attacks you at random, but somebody mm-hmm. that like domestic violence, it doesn't just start as soon as you start dating. Like, it starts with some verbal abuse. And if you don't push back, then they step it up a bit and then step it up a bit. And then maybe they pinch you or something else. But it's never just like, oh, someone's just going to punch you right in the face.
Yeah.
But because people are always like, well, why didn't you leave? And it's just like, look, by the time it got to that bad, I was already just like broken down because of all of those little things that added up. But people, I don't really think they understand like the psychology behind all of that. And I think that also lends to the victim blaming of well, why didn't you just leave? And especially when the victim is male, like, people don't believe that could happen to them at all. Like, they could get abused by their female partner. But that is, unfortunately, like, I don't want to say it's like super common, but it definitely happens way more than we know about because of the stigma.
Absolutely.
Because people don't want to feel less manly or be made fun of or things like that. But to be able to encourage others but still be afraid that something may happen to you, like, that's just the reality of it. And I do think that probably stops a lot of people from coming forward, because they're thinking like, well, like, you know, I have my family to think about, and I don't want any of these repercussions to affect them. So I'm so inspired and motivated by your bravery to do something like this, because it is scary. It really is. And if you were to give any advice to somebody that is in a similar situation to what you were in before, whether it was domestic violence or a rape or something like that, and they don't know what to do, what would you have wanted to hear from someone else?
Go get help. Mm-hmm. Leave the situation and you'll be okay. And it's not easy. And I think the not easy part is one of the most important, because throughout all of those, all of that advice, it's actually really hard. It's really mm-hmm. hard to go tell somebody that somebody did this to you, or to leave. Most women don't leave because of money or children. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Men don't leave because they don't want to feel weak or demasculated. So I would just get out of that situation regardless of what it is. And it is possible. There's shelters. There's churches that will help you. Your friends, your family will help you. There's a way. There's always a way. And I don't care if you have to go to a homeless shelter. It's better than staying somewhere where someone is hurting you so bad. You don't need that Coach purse that he bought you, or those Michael Kors shoes that, you know, are in the closet. Like, that's stuff. You could always buy mm-hmm. stuff later. I my ex-husband, when we got divorced, I gave him everything. Like, I didn't want anything. I just wanted to get out of the situation. And I was mm-hmm. blessed because I was working at the time, because I was in the military. So I had shelter still, even though he left me. But other people don't. Like, go and share your story with people. Like, once you're ready, it's never easy. Mm-hmm. It's never something that's going to come quick. It might take you 10 years, but it is important for you to heal. And, you know, I think like sharing and talking about it with, share it with somebody that's been through it already, or your counselor, whoever, I don't care, your church leader. It is such a healing process to just get it off your mm-hmm. chest. Like, that first, I think I cried the third time that it happened was when I just like bawled. Like, oh my gosh, like, this did happen to me. And I could say it out loud. It was like, oh, it felt like weight off my shoulders almost. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have to hide this anymore, because it took me years to like even be able to say it out loud. And I think people thought I was kidding. So like, people would do things to me, and you know, people who make comments about like domestic mm-hmm. violence and men who go like, oh yeah, just hit her or whatever, like as a joke, mm-hmm. I'll be like, oh, my husband already did that. And they thought I was kidding, but I was serious, but no one knew. They thought I was just like joking. But, you know, you stop joking once you realize like it becomes serious. And once you release it, you're like, oh, that was my way of coping, was like jokes and laughing. Like I laugh a lot when mm-hmm. I tell my story because I don't know what else to do with my face. But, you know, but I do want them to get to this. That makes sense. And I start to ramble sometimes. So, but those are the best things I could tell people is get help, tell somebody mm-hmm. and get out of the situation. And I know it's not going to be easy regardless of whatever situation it is. Rape is harder in my opinion than domestic violence because someone took advantage of your body in such a way that is very vulnerable. So that I understand, and you'll go through a lot of different things we'll go through throughout, depending how you take it. More people are stronger. I became promiscuous because I didn't care about my body after that situation. I was just like, well, if someone's going to take advantage of it, it's going to be me. Like, I'm going to do this before he could do this to me. And that was not the right thing to do. I don't recommend it. But we all have a different process to go through. So I'm not that way anymore, thanks to God. But it was mm-hmm. it was difficult.
Well, I understand. I had a similar reaction. And it kind of followed the same logic of A, I don't care anymore, and B, this is the only way I can be in control of it. So I totally understand. And if there was advice that you could give to someone that they think they might not be believed, what would you say to them?
God knows your heart, and you know that it happened, and some people don't believe me, and that's okay. Not everyone's going to believe you. Not everyone's going to take you seriously. And it's fine. I think it's a inner part of you that you're going to have to work with, and you are going to be the one that's going to forgive this person who hurt you. And then you're going to have to learn without, if that person's important to you who doesn't believe you, I would say go speak with the counselor and that person, or, you know, mm-hmm. tell them again and tell them in a way that they could hear you and see how you feel from that reaction. Because sometimes we're mm-hmm. when that happens, we're just like so hysterical, or we get so angry that, yeah. you know, people stop listening to us once they see we're mad. Or once we start crying, unfortunately, people kind of lose interest. Mm-hmm. And it's not okay. We should be able to cry about like these horrible things that happened to us, but also we want them to hear what we're saying. So don't stop what you're doing. Just continue to tell someone. That person doesn't believe you, fine. Go to the next. Somebody's going to believe you. The cops will definitely believe you, I promise. Mm-hmm. And if they don't,
yeah, well, I hear you.
Them too.
I'm here for it. So in the steps that we've made as the armed forces, the steps we've made forward trying to make this process better for people that have gone through, whether it's sexual harassment or all the way to rape. What else do you think we could do to make people feel comfortable to come forward?
Honestly, I don't know any solutions. Every time I come up with a solution, it just sounds bad. Like, I say it out loud. I'm just like, there's like nothing. We can't change humans. That would be like the best solution mm-hmm. is for people to teach people that this is wrong. Like, you don't take advantage of people this way. And it's still going to happen. I think the best solution is to empower people to go seek help as soon as it does happen, to get out of the situation. Or I hate to say this, but there's like, I wish somebody would have told me, don't put yourself in that situation. And I don't mean that as in like, don't go out or don't wear skirts. That's not what I mean. I mean, like, you kind of start seeing it, or you start knowing yourself. Like, if you're a person who drinks all the time and gets blacked out, and, you know, you show up at your home and you wake up and you're like, I don't know how I got home. Well, you have control in that, and you know that you're going to drink over the limit. And then now we're opening the door for this to happen. Is it okay that it happens? No, it's absolutely not okay. But, and I learned this through my healing process. I take accountability for everything that has happened to me because it gives me power in the situation. Okay. And I know when I speak to other people, they don't like to, like, oh, like, I did nothing wrong. Well, we know you didn't do anything wrong, but, like, if you could take power in that situation, then you could speak about it more powerfully, or you could tell somebody, okay, this is what happened to me. This is my part in it. And this is what he did or she did or whichever. But I don't think we'll ever find a solution for this. It's unfortunately
just
education.
That's, I think there's a whole lot of respect that people need to learn, and empathy for each other, and just knowing that we all come from different places and all have different perspectives. But like at the end of the day, I don't think anybody wants to be hurt like that. So once we all have that realization, I think things will change. And then also there's like, someone had mentioned to me, they were just talking about, like, I guess they never really thought about it from the woman's perspective until they had a daughter. And they're just like, okay, like, I'm just glad at least you got to the point where, like, okay, I can see how my choices would affect someone else's daughter now, like...
Yes, I know.
But
it's like, don't you have a mom and like a grandma?
Right. But I mean, I'm just glad they got to the conclusion of, okay, they also have thoughts and feelings and experiences outside of my own. Imagine that. They're also human. Like,
well, it's funny because
but I mean,
the guy who raped me, he has a daughter now, and everyone, I get asked this all the time, like, well, you know, you could still prosecute him or you could still do all these things. And I said, you know what, I think God gave him a daughter because I feel, and this is what I make up in my head because I've let go of it, that I hope nothing ever happens to that little girl, and that he now has that guilt because he has a daughter that I can't believe I did this to somebody that is a daughter to somebody. Like, I think the Lord gave him a daughter to protect and to hold her and to make sure this doesn't happen to her because of what he did. So.
Absolutely. And I did have like, before, I guess, incels, the involuntarily celibate people. Before that was like a buzzword. I knew a few guys like that in college where it was like always women's fault and da 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 da, and like I hate women, and it was mostly because nobody would date them. But it does seem like once they actually do like find a relationship, and maybe they've changed some things in their head, or they've gotten like a different perspective, and then they have a daughter, then it's like they're the most protective dads. They're like, oh, okay, like I have to do everything in my power. And it's just, I mean, yes, I am 100% glad that they've gotten to that. Ah, yes. This person is a human being, but still, it's just like,
how can we get that before that?
And I think that's also like, right. And I think that's also the problem with sexual assaults, or just military sexual trauma, is like a lot of people don't care until it happens to them or to somebody that they love. So that's the uphill battle that we're also fighting, is just apathy. But I would say my final question in closing is, for any young women that want to join the military, and maybe they don't really have a good knowledge of the world and, you know, all of the things in it. And they're just joining because it's a way to give themselves structure and I guess a way to move forward in adulthood. What would you tell them to either watch out for or do to stay safe, or just how to succeed in a career in the military?
I would tell them, one, do it. It was the best decision I ever made for myself. And if I could tell myself something when I was 21, and everyone tells you this, but you don't listen, so this is serious. Don't marry the first person that is looking at you all hot when you get to your first duty station, because it's true.
And I will co-sign that.
Don't, you know, there's a bunch of them.
Oh,
it's, you know, focus on your career, like for the first 2 to 3 years, focus fully on your career, do every school that's offered to you, and, you know, watch your back and watch your friends' back. Like, if you guys are going to go out and party all the time, have fun and watch each other's back. Mm-hmm. Maybe take turns on who's going to drink that day or who's going to get like wasted or whatever, you know, like you guys could still do all that stuff and protect one another. I think that's really, you know, building that bond with women in the military, even like your guy friends, but having the women bond is totally different.
It is.
And enjoy every moment of it, because one day you'll be 40 years old talking about it with somebody on a podcast and you'll be like, oh, I love those days.
That's so true. I did actually think of one more question. So military culture and alcohol, let's talk about those two.
Oh man. Yeah, seriously.
I went to high school in Germany, and drinking culture over there is different. And I went there because my mom was military, and I have a different sort of, I don't know, respect for alcohol just from like learning about it in teenagerdom over there. But here it's like drink blackout. It's never like, oh, I'm gonna have a glass of wine with dinner. So if maybe someone, if they're joining when they're like 19 or 20 and they're turning 21 in the service, how can they protect themselves from the military drinking culture?
You know, that's a great question. That is, the culture is alcohol. What I did see when I was a federal police officer a few years ago with the Air Force, and it seems like the younger generation doesn't want to drink as much than we did years ago. Like, we would drink as soon as we were off, we were in some bar, just having fun, you know? But I would say be careful, because not only are you could ruin your career, you're going to ruin your body. You could get, you know, a liver cancer. You could just really just hurt yourself. So even though it looks cool and it's beautiful, that's when things really, honestly, every incident that I had that was really horrible in my life had to do with alcohol. And, you know, I do play a part of it. That was something that I fell into the culture of what the Army was. In the Army, there was nowhere to go, so we would just go to the bar. We were in a really, really small town in Alaska. So just take care of yourself is what I would tell people, because no one else is going to take care of you the way you do.
That's so true. That is so true. And also take care of the person next to you on your left and your right.
Yes. So, take care of what you guys do. Make them men.
Yeah, your wingmen in the Air Force. So you guys have battle buddies.
We have battle buddies.
But yeah, it's but I think a big part of just safety in general is just looking out for yourself and the people next to you. And even doing so when you deploy and you have an event like you did. You have that bond with those people, though, because you guys have that understanding of this person is going to take care of me. And when you go through a trauma like that, like you had mentioned before, is nobody else will get it on the level that they do. So I would add to that just the bonds and the friendships that you make in the military are so unique, and they are lifelong. So yes, look out for yourself and the people around you, because when you are done with your commitment and you have all of these memories and you have all these coins and, like, you know, the military memorabilia all around your house, like, all your civilian friends are going to be like, oh, what's that mean? What's this? What that? Uh-huh. But your battle buddy, they just know, you know, you don't have to explain anything.
No, it's like almost like a, like, I don't have to explain everything all. It's like at least once a day, I tell my story to somebody. So sometimes when you're with people, you don't have to think about it. It's just so great.
I hear ya. So Jeanette, do you have anything else coming up? Do you have any more books on the horizon or any projects that you want to share with our listeners?
I'm working on a journal to follow up my book to help people on a daily write things down and heal. Maybe it'll help you write your story. So I'll probably be releasing that either in the summer or in the fall, depending on my work schedule. But I'm really looking forward to that, because I think that they will be great together, because it'll show you how I spoke about my story. And then you'll be able to, you know, begin your healing process with your trauma. And no trauma is smaller than any other trauma. So if you've been in a car accident and you experienced trauma, you had the same reactions as I had to my trauma. And thank you, Rachel, so much for having me today. You're person. What you're doing here, letting us share our stories and speak and, you know, making this go, you know, hit voices that we can't hit. I appreciate it so much. You know, we need more warriors like you doing this. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. I'm just, you know, happy to be the facilitator. But thank you so much for putting yourself out there and sharing your life's journey so far with us. And I will definitely, as soon as your latest journal announcement is there, it will be on the website. So I love promoting other people's stuff. So I really would love to do anything I can to help you get that out there to our listeners. So folks, you heard it here. This is, again, Jeanette Garcia. Her book here is Battle Scars. You can see it back there behind her shoulder. If you want to write her a letter and just tell her how you related to her story, or thank her, or just give her some words of encouragement, there is a Salute to Survivors section on our website. So you'll go there, just click on it, write your name in, and tell her how awesome she is and how powerful and how inspired you are by her. And we will, you know, we'll read those letters in a bonus episode. So thank you again so much for this. It has been an experience speaking with you. And I wish you so much luck in the future and happiness as well.
Thank you, Rachel.
That was our interview with Jeanette Garcia, and she is added to my list of heroes. I don't think I've talked to someone so brave and so determined, and she is just ready for anything, and that is something I really appreciate about her. But she has so many plans for the future, so not only visit her website, WeSurvivedTrauma.com, but also go get her book and subscribe to her blog and see what's happening in the future for her. She has a big future ahead of her, I can tell. But also, if you want to leave her a message, go to our website, go to her episode, and then right between the links that say next episode or previous episode, you will see a button that says send Jeanette a message. Click on that, and you'll be able to send her a note of encouragement, a note of thanks, or just, you know, tell her that you related to her story and you're just happy she's out there trying to make change as well. Next week, our guest is one of a kind as well. I think I say that for every person, but she has found a way to help people turn their trauma into scripts for the stage. And I'm not going to give away any more. Again, I'm your host, Rachel Smith. We'll see you in the next episode. And until then, I invite you to stay safe, be kind, and of course, take care. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Silence Voices Stories of MST. If you found this content helpful, don't forget to subscribe for more resources and support. Remember, you're not alone in this journey. Together, we can create a more supportive and understanding community for survivors of MST. Until next time, we'll see you later.